Okay, thank you for the opportunity. I actually gave a slightly longer version of this same talk earlier in this program, in the beginning of July, and I was very grateful to have the opportunity to come back. A lot of what I do these days is not science, as I'm going to say in a minute, but software development, and my hope is, especially for those of you who have laptops, that I can persuade you to try out the software tools we've been developing for the past 15 years now, which allow relatively compact and easy specification of models in the class of developmental biology and also potentially tumor modeling. And so if you have a computer with you, I would encourage you to get it out. And if you don't want to hear the talk, instead of, as I'm going to say in a minute, instead of looking at your email, try downloading the software and seeing whether it works. And I will be, unfortunately, the NIH scheduled the PI's meeting for tomorrow for me in Montreal. So I have to go to Montreal this afternoon. But I will be here till noon if anyone is interested in trying out this software, maybe to solve some of the problems you're working on for your projects here. First thing I'm going to say about software tools is that a software tool for building models is not a model, just the way Microsoft Word is not a novel. And I have the joke that certainly may be worth writing a novel about how inconvenient Microsoft Word is. On the other hand, for all our complaints about Microsoft Word, life would be even worse if you had to rewrite your word processor every time you wanted to write a letter. And so, while there are wonderful tools available for things like molecular dynamics and finite element, until recently there has been much less support available for doing multi-scale, multi-cell modeling of tissues. And so that was really the motivation for our whole project. And this is not going to be a science talk today. I'm going to give you just a very quick overview of what you can do with the software we've been building. And I'm going to give you two toy model examples. And these are the kind of models that one could build in an afternoon or a day or two if you haven't done this kind of modeling before. And in fact, I was just teaching a week-long workshop in Paris. Got in yesterday via Beijing. That was not the right way to fly from Paris to Toronto, I'll tell you. But the advantage of this kind of framework for modeling building is that it speeds things up enormously, and it makes it practical to actually play. And so the whole purpose of this project is primarily what I've just said, to make multi-cell modeling accessible to people who don't want to write code from scratch. We've also been working on trying to create a standard language that allows simulations to be published, reused, adapted, verified. These are things that people, for example, in bioinformatics take for granted, but this kind of tool is not available so far in multi-cell modeling. And specifically responding to the needs of NIH, but also even before we were NIH-funded, to our own philosophy, to build open-source and platform-independent tools. In some ways, something like Mathematica is a wonderful modeling tool, but if the people you're working with can't afford Mathematica, then it's not very useful. So, my reminder, if you're reading your email, please stop, and you could go to this website, compucell3d.org, and if you go to that website, you will find a link called Source and Binaries, and assuming that you have either a PC running XP or Vista 64, or Vista 32 for Intel chips, our source code does not run on Vista 32 on AMD chips, so it doesn't run on my personal laptop. It's the only computer I know of that it doesn't run on. Or Linux, so Mac, Linux, or anything except Vista 32 for AMD. You can, in fact, just click and follow the installation instructions, and you can follow along. And again, if anyone would like to spend the next couple of hours trying this out, I'd be happy to assist people in getting it going. Okay, and I'm going to give a very, very abbreviated version of this talk, because we started late and don't want to keep you too long. But basically, the whole philosophy of the kind of modeling I'm going to talk about, and I'm going to have exactly one slide on the philosophy after this, is the realization that when you are trying to go from genomics or genetics, and I include epigenetics here, to multicellular behaviors, and after all, what we really care about, whether it's development or cancer or any other kind of disease, is not what's happening inside the cell, but what's happening at the level of cells and above. You don't care if you have a particular genetic mutation as long as your cells behave properly. And so you could separate the question of how do you go from genotype to phenotype, or if you prefer, from genetics and epigenetics to physiology, into two questions. One, how do you go from what's going on at a molecular level inside a cell to the cell's phenomenological behaviors? And then a separate question, which I think cancer researchers are more used to, but many other biologists have a tendency to ignore, which is, given a set of cell phenomenologies, how does that determine the behavior of tissues, whether they're talking about things like development, wound healing, or cancer? And the reason that it makes sense to treat the cell as the unit that you're going to examine is that cells have a fairly limited range of behaviors. And I've listed some of the things that cells can do. Whereas if you try to analyze at the individual molecular level what's going on inside of a cell, you're dealing with potentially interactions of 10 to the fifth plus gene products and post-translationally modified gene products. And any one of those can interact with any other. So if you're going to build classic reaction kinetics models, that means you have potentially 10 to the 10th terms in your reaction kinetics. And if you want to understand how cells have structure, for example, modeling the cytoskeleton, that makes life even more complex. And so it's important to realize in any kind of work that you do, whether you're an experimental biologist, whether you're a clinician, whether you're a mathematician, that you are always building models, and you are always making simplifications, and you are always treating things phenomenologically. About the only people you could say who don't treat things phenomenologically are people who do quantum-based molecular dynamics, and they can just about simulate two water molecules. So everything is phenomenological, and everything involves simplification and modeling. The only question is whether you're going to make those simplifications explicit and try to understand what they're doing, or whether you're going to sweep them under the rug and pretend that you haven't made simplifications. And so if people complain about the simplifications that are made in a given model, it's worth remembering that all biology is based on very extreme sets of simplifications. They're just very often not explicit. Okay. So, for people who have seen this talk before, or not seen this talk before, I'm going to be talking about a modeling method, which we seem to call GGH modeling these days. And this is a very simple way of representing physical structure of biological tissues. Here I have a little microscopy image of an embryo. This happens to be a relatively flat embryo. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this image, I'm going to digitize it, and I'm going to place it on a lattice, square lattice. In this case, model can be two dimensions or three dimensions, that doesn't matter. You could use a square lattice, hexagonal lattice, that doesn't matter either. And each cell in my experiment is going to correspond to a domain of lattice sites, and here I'm zooming in on a little detail. here is one cell here, represented as 10 pixels, and each red pixel here is part of this cell, each yellow pixel is part of this cell, green pixel is part of that cell, and these cells have clearly a volume associated with them, the number of pixels, and they also have a surface which corresponds to the cell membrane. I've drawn little arrows corresponding to cell contact, cell to medium contact, so on. And if you like, if you've done finite element modeling of tissues, for example, you could think of this as a finite element model where you're using a fixed grid instead of an adaptable grid. For computer people, the disadvantage of using a fixed grid is it takes a lot more memory on your computer to describe a given pattern. The advantage is it's much faster to run than classic finite element. And also, you can go from 2D to 3D automatically, whereas in finite element modeling, going from 2D to 3D is quite complex. In addition, you can have as many continuum fields as you like. Here I've shown an extracellular matrix field, matrix degrading enzyme field, and a nutrient field. And so these are classic partial differential equation type models. Okay. So what do you do with this? You need to have some way of describing cells and their interaction. You can neglect the terminology. This is what's called, I don't know why I jumped. See if it'll stay there for a minute. You can neglect the terminology for a moment. This is what's called a pseudo-Hamiltonian stochastic Monte Carlo formalism. We're going to describe the interaction between cells in terms of an effective energy. And the only reason we call this an energy is it inherits that from physics. It's not really terribly important. Some of the terms actually are energies. This relatively complex-looking thing here is actually just the adhesion energy between pairs of cells. Delta is zero if I'm at a link, one of these arrows, that is between two cells that are different. So 1 minus delta is 0 if I'm inside a cell. It's 1 at the surface of a cell. J is the contact energy per unit area between two cells of the type tau of the two cells that are in contact. So this is just the adhesion between cell and cell, or cell and extracellular matrix, due, for example, to cadherins, NCAM, integrins, so on. Each of these cells has a target volume, capital V, target membrane area, S. Lambda here is an elasticity that constrains my cells to be close to their targets. And I can add on, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about this later, energies that will allow these cells, for example, to chemotax in response to an external field, haptotax, and so on. Nice thing about this energy formalism rather than a classic force-based formalism is that if I simply add additional mechanisms to this energy, this model automatically solves all of these things simultaneously. There's a probabilistic dynamics for movement of cells that corresponds essentially to the membrane fluctuations induced by the cytoskeleton, if you like, things like leading edge, or filopodia. So here I have a cell number 2 that's going to try to move cell number 1 out of the way. It's going to try to displace this cell. For example, it's got a little protrusion in the region of its lamellipodium. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at the total effective energy, that E term, before I'd make this change and after. If that effective energy, and I'm sorry that this should started as E in the previous slide, now it's H. I need to fix that. If that change reduces the total pattern energy, I accept it. If it increases the total pattern energy, I accept it with an exponentially decreasing probability. This term T is something that physicists would call a temperature, but from a biological perspective, it's the intrinsic motility of the cell due to cytoskeletal fluctuations. So if I have something like a keratocyte that is zooming around, that number will be large. And if I have a cell that is sitting there and is nearly dead, that number would be very small. And you can actually prove mathematically that with this particular dynamics, picking random sites, looking at protrusions, and accepting things with probability like that, that the boundaries of your cells, and as a consequence, the cells themselves, move in the correct way. In other words, cells move up gradients if they chemotax positively towards those gradients. They stick to each other in the right way, and so on. Now, CompuCell 3D provides a whole library of different things that cells can do. You can write reaction diffusion equations of extracellular chemicals. Cells can stick to each other, they can divide, they can die, secrete and absorb materials, chemotax, haptotax. If you have clusters of cells that are tightly bound to each other, you can implement rigid body motion. If you have cells that, like a keratocytes, tend to move in a given direction for a long period of time, not just sit and fluctuate, you can include that. If you need detail about what's happening inside the cell structurally, you can divide your cells into subcells and build more complex models. You can define cell polarity, cell shape, and so on. Okay. So when you build a model, you're always going to do the same sorts of things. You're going to define what objects there are in your simulation. You're going to define the terms in this effective energy, initial conditions. Parameter value picking is usually the hardest part, and you run it. And so let me just show you very quickly what a program in this funny language looks like. This is going to define the lattice that the cells live on. CompuCell 3D, this is all HTML or XML. People may be familiar with HTML if they've done web pages. XML is just extension of that. Tells you it's CompuCell 3D, defines the lattice size, how long you're going to run the simulation. We should probably change the name. Temperature defines the cell motility. Flip to dim ratio is an old thing. I should take that out too. That defines essentially how fast the cells move compared to some time scale for diffusion in the problem. You list the kind of cells you're going to have in the simulation, cell type, type name, give them an ID number, and then you define the energies that you're going to have. So for example, this says that all of my cells are going to have a target volume of 25, and they're going to have a compressibility in the units of the simulation of 1. All of these cells are going to have a target surface area of 21 latticites. Inverse compressibility is 0.5. This is defining the contact energies between different kinds of cells, and so on. And so a program looks like a list of these statements to define how these cells interact. That allows you to define the basic behaviors of your cells, and for people who want to build cells that are doing more complex things, we also allow you to use a programming language called Python to define any interactions between cells whatsoever. Python isn't the most user-friendly thing in the world. It's an object-oriented language. If you haven't dealt with object-oriented languages, they look initially rather frightening. There's all this gobbledygook here. Fortunately, we provide boilerplate templates where you just change a few lines. So for example, here I'm going to go through my simulation and I'm going to print out the cell ID of each cell, what kind of cell it is and its volume. There's all this gray stuff which you just copy from the template. This says print, this function is called once, so this is an initialization function. And then there's going to be some more boilerplate and you're going to write a line. Print, this function is called every 10 Monte Carlo step. You're going to have a line that says for cell in, forget self, that's another object-oriented thing, cell list, this is a list of all the cells, print the cell ID, the cell type, and the volume. by changing this one line, I could have this cell, for example, increase its target volume at each time step, or with two lines, I could have the cell read in the concentration of a nutrient field and grow with a rate that depends on that concentration, and then divide if it reaches some critical threshold. So this is a wrapper, what's called a wrapper. It is a set of programming tools that live around the core program that allow you to build very complex simulations quite quickly. You interact with this program. The programs are still text-based. We're working on a graphical program generator. It's not ready yet. It's in beta test. But you run these programs through a player utility that allows you to display the positions of the cells, the concentrations of the chemical fields, and so on. Okay, so let me just show you two examples. Very, very simple things that you can do with this kind of model. I'm going to take Sandy Anderson's classic old tumor model. So this is going to be a model where we have normal quiescent mutated necrotic cells. So those are our cell types. We're going to have three kinds of fields. There's going to be some nutrient that's going to determine the cell growth rate, some extracellular matrix that's going to represent both ECM and also the normal tissue around the tumor, and some matrix-degrading enzyme secreted by the cells, tumor cells, that destroys that extracellular tissue. I'm not going to go through the details here. This is just an implementation of Sandy's classical algorithm, which is describing how cells behave. For example, normal tumor cells motile. They stick fairly strongly to each other. They're repelled by the normal tissue surrounding them. They divide. They consume nutrients, and they secrete a small amount of matrix-degrading enzyme. There are also rules that you define for transitions between normal, quiescent, necrotic, and mutated cells. And again, I'm going to just skip the details. If people are interested, I can give you the code for this. And here's Sandy's classical model. Here's the nutrient concentration. Quiescent cells just sit there. If the nutrient concentration falls below a threshold, the cells become necrotic, begin to shrink and disappear. Normal cells divide at a constant rate, and mutated cells divide slightly faster. And here's a 2D section through a three-dimensional simulation now. The normal tumor cells are in green, quiescent are blue, necrotic are black, mutated are red, and we get essentially a compact spherical tumor. And if I run this, it's going to reach a steady state where the number of cells on the surface that are dividing balances the number of cells that are disappearing in the necrotic core. And I know that the proportionality, the size of these various regions isn't realistic. This is just a random selection of parameters. Now, it's also known that near the threshold for cell replication, where the replication rate is controlled by the nutrient concentration, the rate of cell growth actually increases with nutrient concentration. It's not constant. And now I'm going to put that in here so that if I'm just above my threshold for growth, as I increase my nutrient concentration, my cells grow a little bit faster. And what happens when I do that, and I apologize again, the color scheme has changed. So blue is now the normal tumor cells. Black is both quiescent and necrotic. What I see is that instead of getting a smooth tumor, I get a finger tumor that's invasive. I get a lot more of these red mutated cells, and the tumor fingers and begins to invade the surrounding tissue. And it's very easy with a model like this, we'll go to the next slide, to build parameter sweeps where I look at Mac versus PC incompatibility here. Come on. Don't ever try to do anything with a... Okay, come Let's try one more time. Okay. You can do parameter sweeps. It's not going to show. Well, that's the result. Where you study, for example, G here represents the ratio of the growth rate of the cells to the diffusion constant of the limiting nutrient. Gamma here is the surface tension of the normal cells versus the extracellular material. And you can get a family of morphologies that actually can be shown mathematically to correspond exactly to directional solidification. Nice physics problem. Certainly not saying that there's any biology in this. It's just a simple mathematical illustration of the kind of model that you can build using this methodology. And so in this case, at least, this competition for nutrients, and that should be a gamma that got switched when we went to Mac, controls the tumor morphology. Another simple model that you can build is one of very early stages of vasculogenesis in vitro. These are human umbilical vein endothelial cells. This is a movie from a paper of Davide Ambrosi and his colleagues at Torino, some of whom I think are here today. Beautiful paper. Showing the initial randomly distributed cells coming together and forming cell clusters and forming a primary vascular plexus. There are a bunch of models, some of which come out of Vanderbilt, some of which are primarily mechanical, some of which are chemical, some of which depend primarily on chemotaxis. You can actually show that at least to first order, the mathematical structure of the mechanical models and the chemotaxis models is the same, and so you can't actually distinguish between mechanical signaling and chemical signaling by modeling, which is in some ways good, in some ways not. This is, for people who don't remember what chemotaxis looks like, is a fun movie from the Fertile Lab at UCSD showing a Dick Diastelium discoidium cell being tortured by a source of cyclic AMP. And I hope there are no PETA people here to object to the treatment of this poor Dick Diastelium cell. There's a beautiful model of Gamba and Cerini going back about 5 years now, which says that their hypothesis is that these cells are all secreting a vascular endothelial growth factor. Exactly which one is quite problematic. There are a whole series of different isoforms of VEGF-A, and the hypothesis is that in an autocrine fashion, these cells move up gradients of VEGF-A. And again, you can show mathematically that if you assume these cells are sitting on an elastic matrix and are pulling on that matrix and creating a force field around them, the movement would be the same. So you can't actually distinguish chemotaxis from a haptotaxis in this particular case. We've been doing some experiments in my lab focusing on trying to get that nailed down. Unfortunately, there are a lot of conflicting experiments in literature, some of which seem to rule out VEGF-A, other ones of which seem to rule out mechanical signaling. And the model is a tiny bit more complex. Cells stick to each other, and that's this first term. You've already seen it. They have a volume and a surface area. Here, the cells are going to respond to a chemical field, and mu is the rate of response of a cell of a given type, C is the concentration of the chemical, and I have a classic Michaelis-Menten saturation because I know cells don't go infinitely fast in response to a chemical field. I also have a diffusing field, which was also present in the tumor cells, although I didn't show it. It diffuses in the extracellular space, it decays in the extracellular space, and it's secreted by the cells. And the last thing that you need is that there is a little complication for endothelial cells. The vascular endothelial, VE cadherin, vascular endothelial cadherin, which is the main cell adhesion molecule on the surface of these cells, makes the cells stick together, which is nice. It also functions as a signaling molecule. causes dephosphorylation of local dephosphorylation of the receptor for VEGF-A, vascular endothelial growth factor receptor 2. And what that means is that if you have two cells that are in contact with each other via VE cadherin, the surfaces, the membranes which are in contact with other cells, no longer respond chemotactically to VEGF-A. And I took out a slide that shows that, in fact, experimentally, if you knock out VE cadherin signaling, you don't get this vasculogenesis pattern. If you put it in, you get something that's fairly realistic. You can study how this patterning depends on the various parameters. And what it really depends on primarily is the diffusion length of the chemoattractant. In a mechanical situation, that would correspond essentially to the Young's modulus of the substrate. So a more rigid or less rigid substrate would have different pattern lengths. And we actually have some nice mathematics to prove these relationships. Okay. One nice thing about this kind of simulation is that it works equally well in 2D or 3D. This is the identical simulation run in three dimensions. So, for example, if you wanted to look at the capillary plexus behind the retina, sounds like my battery is. Can people still hear me? Okay. You can do that very easily. It takes a little longer to run, but computationally it's no more complex. I love this movie, so I'm going to play it again. That's something that's very hard to do with the finite element model. And here's some very simple toy simulations. I haven't made the vasculature stay connected in this case. Here's a tumor where the vasculature is pulled into the tumor, mainly by cell adhesion, and so you have a vascularized tumor. That tumor, the vasculature is secreting a nutrient that's causing the tumor to grow. And here is a comparable simulation which you might think of, for example, if you do certain kinds of gliomas where the vasculature doesn't actually penetrate the bulk of the tumor. It stays superficial to the tumor. Again, I haven't put in some constraints to make the vasculature stay connected. And so here I've got a situation in which the tumor is vascularizing, but the vasculature is spreading over the surface of the tumor. You get a very different tumor morphology. And this kind of simulation takes about 100 lines of code to write using the methods that I've shown. So you can build fairly complex models in a quite compact way using this technology. Okay. So I haven't talked at all about how you model what's going on inside of the cell. This Python methodology interface that we have allows you to hook in. We're agnostic about the best way to model things inside of cells. We work fairly closely these days with Herb Sauro at University of Washington, Seattle, who's one of the founders and developers both of SBML, interface language, and System Biology Workbench, SBW. System Biology Workbench is a set of tools that allow you to build very elaborate reaction kinetics models of genetic, regulatory signaling, and metabolic pathways inside of cells. If you have a model that you like in SBW, it is a matter of a little bit of Python code, about 10 lines of Python code, to connect that SBW model and run it inside every cell in a simulation of this kind. So you can use then SBW to control the cell behaviors. If, on the other hand, you like using Fortran or C++ or Mathematica or MATLAB to model what's going on inside of the cells, we can provide hooks that allow you to use that again to run inside each cell in a simulation, control the cell's behavior. We don't have at the moment support for CellML, which is the other standard markup language for describing intracellular processes. I hope someday NIH may give us the resources to put in that connection. But SPML is a very powerful way of describing intracellular processes. And we're increasing month by month the support that we provide for that. So most of what I've shown you today is available online as demonstration files on our website. The software, as I say, is relatively simple to use. The XML, writing XML code is really quite trivial. You can learn that in 45 minutes. If you have used a language like Python or MATLAB, writing elaborate code using our template files is quite straightforward. If you have never used an object-oriented language at all, then our estimate is that it takes about a day of playing around to be able to write your own code. Basically, our feeling is that the best thing to do is to provide lots of demo files that do lots of different things and then have people make small tweaks to those to gradually build more complex simulations. We do provide support, albeit not the kind of support you get from a big computer company, which may be good, given our budget. We have been giving workshops on this code in the summers. We gave one last year in Bloomington, another one in June, just gave one in Paris last week. And within a week, people really are able to come and build relatively complex models. A number of groups now have people doing PhDs using CompuCell as the core technology. We also have a little bit of funding to bring people to visit for a week or two if the workshop timing doesn't work out and people want to try it out. If you want to try it out on your own, we have some user support people who are happy to answer questions and help out. And again, I'd encourage you just to try it. Again, you can go to our website here and download it. And depending on the kind of computer you have and so on, I would say we have about an 80% success rate where you just download the files, hit install, the installer runs, and everything works. And occasionally, we discovered, for example, in France, Microsoft very kindly in France has given all of the paths different names. So programs directory has a different name in French. So we had to do a little bit of quick tweaking to get all of our installers to work. As I say, we have some nice tools now for example, doing a GUI for doing an initial condition specification. We're working on some GUIs to allow real-time steering of code so you can change parameters real-time. At the moment, once you start a simulation, you can't change the parameters. What you can do is you can run it for a given amount of time, write out the results, and then run it from that condition onward with different parameters. But you can't actually modify the parameters on the fly. That should be available by the end of the year. Number of other extensions. Perhaps from a computer programming point of view, the most important one is we're going to also support Java, for those of you who like Java, as well as Python. And we're also going to have the SBW transparent, so you're not going to actually have to write any code to use SBW to control cells. Those are all sort of six-month projects. It's been a long project over the years. A lot of people have worked... Oops, what happened? Where did I lose my... Click out here? Right. Not supposed to play, but it doesn't want to play. A lot of people have worked on it over the years, a lot of institutions. This is by no means a complete list of everybody who's been involved and the funding. I used to say that it took 10% of the effort to write research code and 90% of the effort to turn it into use a distributable code, and then it was 1% to write the science and 99% to make it supported, and now it's 0.1% and 99.9%, and I'm sure that by the time this project is finished, we're going to lose another factor of 10 there. If you have code that you think ought to connect to CompuCell, for example, you've developed a wonderful reaction kinetic simulation that you really think we should have running inside these cells, we're very interested in building new collaborations, talking to people about making this as open as possible. As I say, it's a completely open source project. We do get people sending us modules, and once those are checked and debugged, they get included in new releases. Obviously, the more people who use a project of this kind, the more productive it is for everyone. And so I'm hoping that at least one or two of you may be inspired to download it and try it out, if not for a project in this class or this summer school, maybe for something in the future. So thank you very much for letting me come and talk to you, and hope I'll be here for the next couple of hours if anyone has any questions.